requires resilience. Like if you're going to walk the Yorkshire Three Peaks or the National Three Peaks, they require really sticking with it, really kind of staying with the thing. They require resilience. Any long journey requires resilience. And the longest journey is one that spans our entire lives. It's a long journey. It's a really difficult journey. And we need resilience in order to go through it well. Now, if we're going to talk about our spiritual lives, we need a resilience beyond ourselves. That's the whole point of something that's spiritual. Something's beyond us, beyond the physical world. We don't have what it takes in us for this journey. And we need something more than that. And that is what God has always offered us through Jesus. Now, the main metaphor in these sections of the Psalms is one of a journey, one of a pilgrimage, or a long walk, a really long walk, a walk with Jesus. And we need resilience to stay on that path. But what if we don't have it? But it's something that we need. What if we don't have what we need? Life post-COVID and pro-comfort is a world with less resilience than before, for generally for everybody. In all areas of life, people just want to stay in. Relational conflicts are more difficult because people don't want to deal with them or they don't have the tools. Plus, the relationships we have, they're not strong anyway. And so any kind of tension, all of a sudden, those things break. If we don't have the resilience that we need, we will either give up, give in, or burn out. So we'll give up. Life is too much. We have too many things coming at us. And you know what? We're just like, oh, whatever. I just can't take this thing anymore. So we give up on God, we numb the pain, alcohol, weed, binging TV series, you know, we quit. We just turn the volume down a little bit and we fade out. Or we give in, we just go with the flow. We end up not caring as much and just find it easier to just kind of give in and do whatever other people are doing. It's passive, it's not really an active working. If you're a Christian, that means just letting the world be as it is. Like, ah, well, it's okay, like these people, I'll just let them do their own thing. Most men I know, this is a really big thing for men. Generally, this is our like besetting sin. We're tired and we just want to be passive and we make excuses for it. Now, or we burn out. We either explode, we go out in a rage, we say things or do things that we normally can keep a lid on, or we implode and we give the whole world the cold shoulder. There's no resilience here in these things. We end up in any one or combination of all three of these things. There's no hope there. Like we've tried going our own way. This is how to try it. We've tried it and it doesn't work. There's no joy here. There's not an active working towards something good. It's not just bad for us. It's bad for other people. So when bad things come our way without resilience, we crack. And we know bad things are going to come our way. Like that's an inevitability. I don't have to be a prophet to tell you bad things are going to happen. Like it's just going to happen. Now, one of the areas of the church that I've found to be lacking most in our time and place, just generally in the West, is resilience. A resilient faith is really hard to find. And the knock-on effects are everywhere, in the home life and work life and church life, all sorts of places. Now, when we have Jesus, though, he gives us the resilience that we need. And that means resilience is not something that we work really, really hard to try and cultivate ourselves. Yes, there's working, but that's not first what we do. We search after the one who already has all of it. And then he gives it to us. It's a gift that we get to have. A relationship with Jesus, we find in him that we need to go through difficult times and to strive for something better, not just for us, but for the world. So the three things we're going to talk about today, I'm going to give it to you ahead of time, the Cliff Notes version. Source of resilience, resilience in the face of injustice, and a resilient prayer. So we're going to look at the source of resilience, what resilience looks like in the face of injustice, and then what a resilient prayer can look like at the end of this chapter. So the very first two verses, we read about the source of resilience. The people here, they're described as mountains. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion. Normally, Mount Zion is a way to describe like God's presence, but that's what these people are described like. They're like a mountain that cannot be shaken, endures forever. That's pretty resilient. I've never seen a mountain go away. That sounds like mountains are going to stay there for a while. Now, what's the source of that, though? The source is these people are defined as those who trust in the Lord. That's who these people are. It's not those who are strong. It's not those who have enough money. It's not those who have power. It's not those who figure things out in this world. It's those who trust in the Lord. Trust in the Lord is what gives us resilience because he's the source of resilience. How can you get it if you don't go to the source? Trusting in him is what allows us to access it. Now, those who locate their own security and not in themselves, but in the Lord, find themselves resilient. Our instinct is to protect ourselves first and think about ourselves first, but that's not what the psalm teaches us. It says to locate that security outside of ourselves in the Lord, and then we get the resilience. Those who believe that God is who he says he is, that he's good for us, he's good with us, Those people who believe that wholeheartedly, they are resilient. And then what do we see the Lord doing in verse 2? As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people both now and forevermore. He surrounds his people. He covers them. And in fact, this word surround is not a static thing. It's active. It's like a roundabout going around and around kind of thing. He's not off somewhere else. We are surrounded by him right now. He's here surrounding us in his resilient love. Even when we're surrounded by enemies, he's surrounding us. Even when we're surrounded by shame, by our disappointment, by uncertainty, by the things that disrupt all the peace in our lives. Always, for the Christian, we are also surrounded by the Lord, even closer than any of those things. And it's that fact that can cause us to be resilient no matter what else might surround us. If the Lord is surrounding us all the time, actually it doesn't really matter what else comes at us. There's an idea that this psalm brings up here. Theologians have used this term perichoresis for it. Now, I don't think you probably have heard that in general kind of day-to-day speech. I normally don't bring up big theological terms, let alone Greek ones themselves. This is a chance for my nerdery to really show through. But this is actually, it's important. So if you look at this word and break it into the two, peri means like about or around. Choresis means like dance or movement. It's where we get the word choreography. And so this a dancing around, a dancing about. This is it's a kind of a general theological term to describe how the Trinity interacts with itself, how the Trinity exists. Perichoresis describes that relationship. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit, they're all involved in this eternal dance with each other, but also within each other. They are together as much as they are separate. That's a really difficult thing to wrap our heads around because nothing in our lives, we don't experience life that way. So difficult Trinitarian theology aside, and we'll get to that maybe some other day. Here's where that comes into play for this psalm. The Lord surrounds his people. In the same way the Trinity is at work with each other and in each other, for those who are God's people, that's what's going on with us. For people who follow Jesus, we're brought into this dance. We're brought into this dwelling with the same force and power and reality that the Father and the Son and the Spirit experience with each other. That's what we have because God does not hold anything back from us. And Jesus can pray this way in John 17. It's called the high priestly prayer before Jesus goes to the cross, the very last kind of long prayer he gives in the Gospel of John. Jesus says, I pray for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. Just as the Father is in the Son. That's the kind of oneness that we're going to have. May they also be in us. May us be in us, the Trinity, so that the world may believe you have sent me. I have given them the glory you gave me. We get glory? That sounds heretical. No, we get the glory that gave me, that they may be one, I and them, and you and me, that they may be brought into complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. So many things we could say about this, but we're only focusing on that unity, that oneness, that kind of eternal dance that we have with the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Just as the Trinity experiences unity, and we would say that's pretty unified. You don't get much more unified than within the Trinity. Just as the Trinity experiences unity, oneness, that perfectness, that completeness, that wholeness, that's what we already have for those who follow Jesus. It's already happening. It never doesn't happen for those who follow Jesus. We get to be perfect. We get to be complete. We get to be whole. We're brought into the dance. And now the triune God lives in us, even as our ears get attuned to the music. So we heard this music here. Like we experience, anytime we open this up, the music is coming at us and teaching us how to dance. And we experience this unity together, even as we try and have our movements match what we hear. We're learning this dance together in the church. We're surrounded by the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. If you're a Christian, this is your state of being. You don't do anything to get it. God's given it. It's a gift. You are never not part of this. You're never not surrounded by the Creator of heaven and earth. The more we realize that and lean on it as if it's true, because it is, you can see how that connects to a resilient faith, if that's what's really going on all the time. So let's live in reality then. Let's take it. That's what reality is. To live in other ways, to live in some kind of false world. Let's live in the real world where the Lord is always surrounding us, always working around us. To take it means to listen to the music, to have spiritual ears to hear. We listen even just a little bit, and our souls soar. As we listen, we act. In the dance of following Jesus, there is a movement, there is an action. And as we follow through together as a church, we also grow in resilience. Now, there can sometimes be like an evangelical anxiety that if I don't feel something, and there's something wrong with me, or I shouldn't do whatever the thing is. I'm doing it wrong if I'm not feeling it right. Something I hear often is like, I don't want to read my Bible if I don't have the desire to, because then I'll be like a Pharisee or a hypocrite or something. And you know, maybe that's true sometimes. But sometimes the desire precedes action. Sometimes my desire comes before the thing I do. And that's great when that works out. But sometimes the opposite happens. Sometimes action has to come before desire. You do something that you don't want to do, and eventually you want to do it. Or at least you're glad that you did it. It's like going to the gym. I don't always look forward to going to the gym. Very rarely I'm like, yes, I can't wait. But then when I'm done, I don't think I've ever been in time like, oh, I can't believe I went to the gym. That was horrible. I'm always like, ah, actually, no, I was all right. And you know what? 5 minutes in, I'm generally like, oh, I'm glad I did this. Same kind of thing with any kind of active obedience thing that we're called to do as Christians. We're called to be obedient regardless of if we feel it or not. And now we can and should ask God to shape our desires and want us to do those things. We should want to obey. But how do we act when we don't have that desire? A resilient faith is one that still follows through, even when our hearts might lag a little bit. That doesn't mean we're hypocrites, doesn't mean we're Pharisees, just means we're obedient. And a weak faith is one that's focused on our own emotional state and that evangelical anxiety of always having to feel it. It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And it's not really an enjoyable way to live, because then your life is either up or down depending on if you feel good about your relationship with God or not. That is, our emotions are a poor mediator of God's love. Only Jesus is a good mediator of God's love. So let's trust in God in the way that we've talked about. That kind of trust leads to being resilient, leads to being more of a mountain, not being shaken, because we trust the God who is there. Now, if you aren't a Christian yet, anyone should know. Anyone can get in on this. Your background, whatever it is, your spiritual experience, whatever it is in the past, none of that hinders you. In fact, what God absolutely loves to do, and I bet all of us who are Christians would have some aspect of this story in the back of our lives. God loves to use our broken past as a way for us to experience even more of him, not less of him. And I think that's an amazing thing. Now, the real test of resilience, though, is how we approach things that are difficult. It's really easy to say you're resilient when everything's working out for you, but what about when things aren't? And verse 3 is just about that. How are we resilient in the face of injustice? Verse 3 says, the scepter of the wicked will not remain over the land allotted to the righteous, for then the righteous might use their hands to do evil. So being resilient when things are good, that's easy, but when things are bad, that's where we get tested. I mean, is there anything that makes our blood boil more than rampant injustice? It rightfully gets us angry. That's a good thing. But here's what's going on in verse 3. I'm like, what in the world does that mean? The righteous, and the righteous is another way to describe God's people. The righteous, that it's not just a term for people who are perfect or whatever. It's just the people who follow God. The righteous had land. Wicked people stole this land from them. And the way they did that is because they were the ones in power. They hold the scepter of the wicked. So not only do they steal this land, they're in charge, they have the scepter. The wicked are ruling now over the righteous, even as they steal from them. So insert political application here. Insert also the global effects of our own consumerism here, all those kinds of things. If this happened to you, though, how would you react? Something got stolen from you, and the person who stole it from you is in power. You've all had aspects of that in your lives. Would you be passive and just let it happen? Would you kind of get all aggro and show them what it's like, and then you become the oppressor that they were to you? You know, this psalm puts a larger frame around the injustice. See, the rule of the wicked is not forever. It will not remain. It might feel like it's forever in the moment, but it will not remain. They might rule now, but this won't always be. And then add the truth of the previous point, that we are with this inter-Trinitarian dance eternally. That dance does last forever. The wicked's reign doesn't. So if we believe this and act as if it's true, this leads us who are the righteous, who are victims of injustice in whatever ways it might have been, it leads us to refrain from evil, to kind of paying them back for what they did to us. That is resilience in the face of injustice. Now, this does not fix the problem of injustice, but it does allow us to go through it. And often, God leads us through darker valleys so that we can grow through resilient faith. Now, some of you know the story of my trial and my dad. As a bit of a recap, if you don't, and I'm not going to spend loads of time on this. By the way, anytime we talk about this story, people might be like, ooh, can I talk to Greg about this? You can talk to me and Christine about this. Like, we're completely fine talking about this if you've not heard it before. But my father was the ringleader for a group of people who committed mortgage fraud during the housing boom in the 90s and the early 2000s. When the housing crisis hit in America, some of his crimes started to surface. He was missing for a few years. The FBI was trying to find him. I was told by many of my family members that either he was hiding from organized crime members or was dead. Eventually, the FBI did find him. He was on the run for those 2 years. But he was obviously guilty. There was loads of evidence against him. He made millions of dollars off banks and lending companies. What he would do is he would inflate the prices of houses and then also create these fraudulent mortgages in order to get the kind of money lent from the banks. And he would pocket all the extra money. And then the houses would just be foreclosed on, and so he would get even more money from that. Sometimes he did that from stealing identities from other people, like he did for me. He filled in a fraudulent mortgage form with my personal information so he can make some extra money. It's around $30,000. Now, since he had that info already, he stole another $20,000 from filling out fraudulent credit cards in my name. But when the FBI finally caught him, they made a deal. They said, the more people you help us put in prison, the more lenient we're going to be when it comes to sentencing. Because you're going to prison. We know you're going to prison. But if you want to get less prison time, tell us all the guilty people. And so my dad named all his kind of co-conspirators, some of which were my family members, and he named me as well. And so because of that, I was arrested, charged with a federal crime, got arrested by the FBI, spent the day in jail, swabbed for DNA, fingerprinted all the works. I saw a judge, and the very first legal paper that I saw in this whole thing, when finally someone told me what was going on after this whole day of being in a jail cell by myself, across the top in big block letters, United States of America versus Greg Wilson. All the states against me? Like, what'd I do? I had no idea why I was in there, actually. And so, but then I found out after reading that page. I found out really quick. So if convicted, I was looking at 4 years in prison for something that I didn't do. I couldn't travel outside my little county in Florida for 2 years unless I had special permission. We had really trouble sleeping, anxiety, numbness, loads of anger. I mean, there was a lot more that could be said there. And again, I'm happy to chat more about that. But, you know, we only have so much time. So we'll fast forward to the end. Eventually, it ended up being a large, big federal trial in a very large, big federal courthouse. I'd never been in a federal courthouse before, but the marble columns themselves are just imposing. The architecture is meant for you to know you don't have any power. So at my trial, the star witness against me was my dad, on the stand for 2 days, telling the whole courtroom, all the jury, how I was guilty. But right at the end, the last 15 minutes of his 17-hour testimony, my dad told the truth. He said, Greg actually didn't know anything about this. And if I got the same information that I told Greg, I would have followed through as well. All this kind of stuff. Then every witness the prosecution brought up either didn't know who I was because I'm innocent, or if they did know who I was, they're like, oh, why is Greg here? He's innocent. Like, well, I don't understand. This is a trial for Greg. He shouldn't be here. So either they didn't know me or they did, and they didn't think I should have been there. So the prosecution presented their case, and they arrested the judge actually at the end of that. Threw the entire case out because there was no evidence against me at all. So the whole 2 years worth of government's work against me was pointless because there was no evidence. And from that day on, the judge kind of set something basically not only threw the case out, but I've never been charged, threw the charges themselves out because I shouldn't have been there to begin with. Now, that's a great story of God coming through for us, being there for us, surrounding us in so many ways. There's so many more like wonderful things to talk about during that really horrible time. But I share that story for the reason here. Going through difficult things gives us the opportunity to build up resilience. Going through difficult things gives us the opportunity to build up resilience. If we didn't go through that trial, we wouldn't have contemplated being directly involved in church planting. I wouldn't have moved to another state to help with another church plant. I certainly would not have moved here. We wouldn't live here. We wouldn't have been involved in church planting. And if we did move here, we would not have had the resilience that we needed to get through all the difficult things that we have since leaving here. That trial was easily, like without even a doubt thinking about it. And the lawyer that represented us said, Greg, I know you're innocent and I know you don't deserve to go to jail. This will be the worst thing you will ever go through in your life. It's worth actually just pleading guilty and being done with it. And I was like, I really don't want to go to prison. It's like, okay, fair enough. Let's go on. So it's easily the worst thing that's ever happened to us, and yet God has used it as one of the most important aspects of our faith. God's gift of resilience often comes through our darker valleys. Now, just going through a valley itself, that's not very helpful. That's pretty horrible, just being in the dark place. But we have to take advantage of it. We have to go through it well. And we did not do it perfectly. In fact, I don't even know if we did it well. But God really has given us a lot of gifts from it. So if you want resilience, don't avoid the difficult things. I'm not saying get arrested. I'm saying there will be difficult things, and we are created in order to avoid those difficult things. And I get that. We shouldn't be looking for pain. But when we go through them, especially things that we know we're called to do, but it's going to be a bit difficult, we can't avoid those. There's a reason those things are in front of us. We understand more about God going through his difficult things that we wouldn't if we didn't. And so those darker valleys, the whole point of that is for us to grow, one of the points, for us to grow in our trust in the Lord. When we trust in him, what we see, actually, the wicked aren't always going to rule. Even if I did go to prison for something that I didn't do, and even if my life was completely horrible after that, God still would have kept me. He still would have kept us. God is not the fixer of all our problems as much as he allows us to go through our problems. So when someone takes something from you, your joy, your trust, your money, whatever the thing might be it big or be it small, what do you do? Not trusting the Lord can lead us to be passive. We just let it happen and we become victims. Not trusting the Lord also can make us oppressors. We're either going to be those victims or we're going to be the oppressors. We're going to get them back in the same way they got us. Trusting the Lord is the most difficult of those options, but it's really the only good option. We're not victims, we're not oppressors, but we're righteous. We're not perfect, we're righteous. We're God's people following in his way. And as we dwell on God coming through for us in the darker valleys of the past, we can pray for God to continue that work in the future. A resilient prayer is hopeful, especially in the face of injustice. And if verse 3 is the situation that these people are in, for anyone to look at anything hopeful after that, that's resilient in itself. That's a rebellious kind of resilience. So resilient prayer is when the prays for justice and for peace to come through regardless of the situation that we might find ourselves. We trust in the Lord now, but we also trust him in the future. So even when the wicked rule, trusted in the Lord leads to resilience. And those who have resilience, if you have that, then you have the resources to work for peace, to work for justice in ways that you wouldn't otherwise. This is a prayer for justice, these last two verses. Lord, do good to those who are good, to those who are upright in heart. But those who turn to crooked ways, the Lord will banish with the evildoers. Peace be upon Israel. It's a prayer for justice. May God be good to those who are good, to those who in their hearts are standing tall. They might be broken on the outside. Their backs might be bent over with the burdens that are upon them. But the recipients of justice are those who internally have righteous hearts. And for those who aren't righteous, those who do so much evil becomes their identity, evildoers. It's like, that's who you are now because you've done so much evil. May God throw them out. May God kick them out of his presence. And you can't pray this prayer. You can't actually pray it unless you have a resilient faith. Otherwise, it might be words, but you're not going to believe it. You won't be praying to God for change. You'll be focused on yourself to do it. And really, that's never, if it goes well, it's also not going to be really all we need, but generally it doesn't go well anyway. So the only really way to pray this, the only hope to live this out, is to be the people of resilient faith. People who have been through dark valleys and can look back and see God at work. Not the people who avoid the hard things. To pray this prayer means to surrender to God's goodness to us and to stand with all who seek it. It's the prayer of God, won't you be good to us? We're here. This is really difficult. We're in this valley. We're in the muck. We're in the dirt. We need to be lifted up. Who's going to do that? This is a goodness beyond us. Something that we don't have, and we're asking for it. We surrender to God's goodness in our hearts, and we pray for more of it for us. And as we do, we pray for that to take over the hearts of other people as well. I mean, this very last verse, praying for peace being on Israel. We've talked about that word peace before. It's an all-encompassing flourishing. It's not just absence of bad things. It's the presence of all the good things as well. It's a wholeness. To pray for that while in a dark valley, to pray for wholeness while you're in a dark valley, that's really difficult. That's resilient. And it's a rebellion against the way that it seems to be, but always connected to the way that things truly are. Those who pray this way, when their circumstances are not perfect, that's a resilient faith. But before we assume that we are the good, that we are the righteous, are we? How can we really pray this prayer? Aren't we crooked? Haven't we used our power that we have, whatever it might be, for ourselves first and not for others? That's not just. Haven't we used our hands for evil? We don't deserve peace. We deserve to be the people who are banished. We deserve to be exiled. And that's exactly what happened in the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis. We're people who were given everything, and what we do with that, we messed it up, and you can say, oh, horrible Adam and Eve, we would do the same exact thing. And that's just kind of what the story of Genesis is about. This is who we are. So then what happens is God kicked us out. We were exiled from the Garden of Eden, exiled from God's presence because of it. No longer in the dance. And in our exile, we also introduced death. Surely that's the biggest injustice. Death was not what we were created for. And the most difficult spot, the darkest valley, is death, and it happens every single day. As if it's normal. If we're honest, we're more like those who aren't righteous than those who are, really. Who among us is perfect? That's what righteousness is. It's goodness. So if you're not perfect, you're not righteous. But that is the story that Jesus walks directly into. He did not avoid the hard thing. He walked right into it. He came into his own country, came into his own world. He created it, and yet he was also exiled from it. Do you know where Jesus was crucified? Is in Jerusalem, but not in the city, outside the gates, exiled. It's too far for a Roman, far too shameful for something like a crucifixion to happen around other people, to happen around our city. We're not going to defile our city. Like, it's going to be outside the city gates. The wicked were in charge, religious leaders, political leaders, religion and politics together, generally not a good thing. And they treated Jesus like an evildoer, exiled outside the city, but Jesus stayed the course. Before we can even imagine resilience for ourselves, Jesus was all of it. And he, all of him, was all righteous. And in his resilience, he won for us the peace that this psalm is telling us to pray for. In Jesus' resilience, he won for us the peace that this psalm is telling us to pray for. What happened through the work of Christ on the cross was this great exchange. He got from us all of our wickedness. He got from us all of our identity as evildoers. He got our guilty hands, our lack of resilience, all our passivity, all the overtop aggression, and all of that set on the cross with him. And we never get to see that thing again. We never get to see any of that again. And then what we get in return from him is his righteousness. We get all of his goodness. And through that, we also get his resilience. And he enables us to live in the way this psalm is talking about. In order for us to be righteous, for us to be the righteous that this psalm is talking about, we need his righteousness because we don't have that ourselves. And so through Jesus' death and resurrection, that's what we get. We get to be that. We get to be the righteous in this psalm because of what Jesus has already done. And that's how this psalm can be true. It's not true if that didn't happen. And that's how it can be really good news for us. And as we eat and drink, we celebrate this righteousness from God. It's not from us, it's a gift that's been given. Just like if you go to someone's house for dinner, they're giving you a gift of food. And as we have it, we're called to walk in it. The road that we're on, the path of the righteous, it's surrounded by the presence of God. We're never on our own. It's not a lonely walk of an exile, but the joyful dance of the Father and the Son and the Spirit with us, the church. We take this time together as the church, not as individual pilgrims on our own individual journeys, but as a pilgrim people on one journey together. And the more we do this, the more our faith grows in resilience. The more we pray this when things are easy, the more we will when things are not. The more peace we experience, the more we'll seek after others' peace. And whatever might come at us in life, even when death itself comes, and it will, we don't just walk, we dance. Now, on the cross, we talked about how Jesus died. And when he died, his life was broken, his life was torn, wrenched away from that perfectness. And if we're connected to him, all that brokenness that we have in our life that was put on him, that caused him to be broken, we get to be relieved of that. And on the cross, his blood was poured out. And in that darkest of dark valleys that he went through, in a resilient way that we will never know because we will never have to go through that kind of dark valley because of him. Because he's gone through it, we can go through ours, whatever it might be, even our little deaths, and we will experience death, but it's not going to be the same way that Jesus experienced death because he took all of our sin with him as well. That's something, if you're connected to Jesus, you will never know. You'll be completely, blissfully ignorant of what that's like because Jesus has it away from us. So as we eat and as we drink, let's contemplate that and how that's good news for us, those who are going through dark valleys, but also good news for other people who don't know him yet, that we ought to be saying, peace be upon Israel. Who is God's people? Well, we know it's these people now. Yep. But we have all these empty chairs. And I know that God's at work. And I know more people are going to fill them. And so we're going to pray for them, for more peace to be on more people. Now, if you don't follow Jesus yet, we're really glad that you're here, or if you're in conflict with somebody else that you haven't sorted out yet, this table's not for you today, right now. But it is worth contemplating the things that we talked about in light of those two things. For those who do follow Jesus, what we get to do is we get to celebrate this together. We get to joyfully come up together. You don't have to be a member of Redeemer to eat and drink. You just need to be a member of God's church. Now, for those who come up, we trust in Jesus. We're with Jesus on his way. And because of that, we don't give up. We don't give in. We don't burn out. We get to dance with him. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your grace.